available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Welcome to Outlook. My name's Peter Walters, and this edition's being recorded on Wednesday, the 26th of November, 2025. We've got a very mixed bag coming up for you. Ants and Lee Child, Bagot's Castle, and the Winter Solstice, amongst many other things, plus sport and postbag, our usual features. But first of all, here's this week's news with our readers, Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
Near misses between drivers, pedestrians and cyclists at a Coventry Road junction have been cut by more than 88% thanks to sensors that use artificial intelligence, AI. The technology was used by Transport for West Midlands to analyse near misses at the junction of Grange Road and Anderson Road in Longford and work out how they could be reduced. The resulting pedestrian refuge installed by Coventry City Council using the Transport for West Midlands funding has slowed down turning traffic and dramatically reduced the risk of collisions. Richard Parker, Mayor of the West Midlands, said, "One life lost on our roads is one too many. That's why I'm committed to Vision Zero. No more deaths on our roads. We need to use every tool available to make journeys safer for everyone. And this new AI technology is helping us prevent collisions before they happen. Coventry is leading the way as the first place to roll out new safety measures that have been guided by AI. And the results show how this technology really can improve safety and save lives. The pedestrian refuge has reduced the speeds of vehicles involved in near misses and forced drivers not to cut the corner when turning into Anderson Road from Grange Road. The AI-powered vision sensors work by detecting and recording near misses, such as when a vehicle passes within inches of a slower-moving pedestrian or cyclist. This means potential collision hotspots can be identified before someone is hurt. In the past, highway authorities had to use data from actual collisions to identify safety issues, meaning someone generally had to be hurt, or worse, before a danger hotspot could be pinpointed. At Grange Road, sensor footage from before the refuge was installed showed vehicles stopping just inches from people crossing the road, including a mother with a child in a pushchair and a dog walker. It is one of 40 sensors that have been installed at junctions across the region as part of a pilot to assess the near-miss and smart road safety technology. Transport for West Midlands, part of the West Midlands Combined Authority, is working with Viva City, who developed the technology, and local councils to investigate issues and potential solutions at more sites across the region. Matt MacDonald, the region's Road Safety Commissioner, said, "It should never take a death or a serious injury before we fix roads that are putting people in danger. This pilot shows exactly how we can anticipate, measure and mitigate these harms before tragedy strikes for yet another family." Councillor Patricia Heatherton, Cabinet Member for City Services at Coventry City Council, said, "By combining AI sensors with practical measures like the new pedestrian refuge, we've cut near misses at Grange Road by more than 88%. Slowing turning traffic and protecting pedestrians and cyclists shows how technology and local action can work together to save lives and make our streets safer for everyone."
And another story to do with the road safety. An awareness campaign is being planned in Coventry to warn parents of the dangers of e-scooters and e-bikes, particularly in the run-up to Christmas. The issue was brought up at a recent Coventry City Council meeting, with the bikes and scooters likely to be on so many people's Christmas lists this year. They are already banned from some parts of the city centre, but members of the Council's Scrutiny Coordination Committee said that more needed to be done. Councillor Lynette Kelly said, parents will be buying these for their kids without realising that they can be too fast and dangerous. She said more legislation was needed to restrict their use and added, it should be an offence to sell them if they go more than 15 miles an hour. Councillor Gary Ridley agreed, personally, I'm sick and tired of walking out of the front door of this building and nearly being run over. I recognise that resources are finite, but this is one of those things that does have an effect on people's lives, he said. He drew a comparison with how, 50 years ago, there were some people who still thought it socially acceptable to drink alcohol and drive, but people had been re-educated and laws had been passed. He said, we now need to go into schools and teach kids about the proper place to use e-bikes and e-scooters.
A figure skating club from Coventry said it is gutted to be closing after 14 years. Coventry Figure Skating Club, a community-run not-for-profit, said it had to dissolve after losing rink time at Planet Ice Coventry earlier this year. A spokesperson said the club has been a big part of the city's sporting and community life, and its members are heartbroken at the loss. More than 40 skaters gathered for a farewell party last Friday, in what the club said was a reflection of the sense of belonging the club had created. The club rented time with Planet Ice for an hour every Saturday, through an agreement with the International School of Skating. The group said it had tried to negotiate ice time with Planet Ice and International School of Skating, but neither business felt in a position to support the club to continue. A club's spokesperson said, "The club has supported skaters of all ages and abilities, running affordable and fun skating sessions and fundraising for charities such as Acorns Children's Hospice and Macmillan Cancer Support. Unfortunately, after losing our ice time earlier this year, we were unable to continue, despite strong member support. Our members are heartbroken but proud of what the City Skating Club has achieved, and we feel our story deserves to be shared as part of Coventry's local sporting and community history." Planet Ice told the BBC the club contacted them to secure ice time outside of the ISS earlier this year. The firm said it did not have an issue negotiating time on the rink if ISS did not have any objection. A spokesperson said, "Planet Ice would be extremely happy to hire ice to Coventry Figure Skating Club that meets all the necessary legislative requirements at a time that is convenient for all stakeholders."
A new proposal to bring motorsports back to Coventry Stadium in Brandon, alongside new housing, has been branded a sham and a deception by campaigners. Stadium owners Brandon Estates have drawn up revised proposals for up to 115 new homes alongside a fully restored speedway track. In 2014, the company first proposed to demolish the stadium, the former home of the Coventry Bees Speedway racing team, and build homes on the site, and the venue closed in 2016. Rugby Borough Council's planning committee refused a revised application in 2022, with a subsequent appeal rejected by the planning inspectorate last year. A Brandon Estates spokesperson said, "We're committed to finding a viable future for this site and have spent many months considering our options following the refusal of our previous applications. Since 2016, the site has remained in a significant state of disrepair, with Speedway completely unable to return without substantial investment. We understand that living alongside a derelict site has created concerns for local residents, and we are committed to working with the community to secure a sustainable use for the site." The company says it intends to lease the track to a local Speedway operator. But the Save Coventry Speedway and Stocks campaign group, alongside members of a consortium who wish to buy the stadium, greeted the plans with scepticism. A spokesperson said, "Brandon Estates really have no intention of ever reinstating the stadium for Speedway racing. They speculated that the company would try to get around the planning inspector's decision by building the 115 homes before submitting another application to demolish the stadium and build yet more housing. They said, given that Brandon Estates and their agents have repeatedly stated their belief that Speedway is not viable and that satisfactory venues exist elsewhere, it appears very surprising that they're now proposing a Speedway facility. The group added that the poor condition of the site was due to Brandon Estates' failure to secure the site from travellers, vandals and arsonists, for which the company was actually fined £10,000 in 2022, after the stadium was broken into a number of times and set on fire. The Brandon Estates spokesperson wholeheartedly disagreed with the campaign group's concerns. They said Brandon Estates is fully committed to the long-term ownership and maintenance of the site. Our revised proposals will secure mutual benefits for residents and Speedway supporters, balancing the need for new homes alongside the delivery of sports facilities and ensuring a sustainable financial model for the future of Speedway racing in Coventry. We intend to submit our application in coming weeks and are keen to hear from local residents to help us shape the plans.
A charity Christmas tree collection service in Warwickshire is hoping for yet another bumper year. The annual collection of real Christmas trees is organised by Pass the Smile with the Mighton Hospices. In return for a donation, volunteers will collect and recycle real trees. The 2026 collection will take place over the weekend of Friday, January the 9th to Sunday, January the 11th. Every tree collected is responsibly recycled, helping to reduce waste and protect the environment, while also raising vital funds to support patients and families across Mighton's hospices and within the wider community. Donations additionally contribute to funding research into childhood cancer. Since 2019, the initiative has collected over 14,000 Christmas trees, raising an impressive nearly £212,000. This year, the hospice aims to collect and recycle 4,000 real Christmas trees, expanding its coverage to all CV postcodes. Each tree will be recycled into compost or biomass, offering a convenient, eco-friendly way to dispose of Christmas trees while giving back to local causes. Mighton spokesperson Claire Cropp said, "The support we receive for our Christmas tree collection is truly amazing. Every tree collected not only helps the environment, but also makes a real difference to the lives of patients and families in our hospices and to children across the UK. This year we want to build on that incredible support so even more people can benefit from the work of the Mighton Hospices and Pass the Smile. You can register, book a collection by visiting justhelping.org.uk, register-tree to book."
Two further brief charity stories. The organisers of an annual festive tractor run have invited children to enter a competition to design a character for one of its trailers. Sheepy Tractor Run will take place on the 12th and 13th of December, with a different route each day. The first day will see the procession travel through North Warwickshire, while on the second day the tractors journey through Bedworth, Nuneaton and Coventry. This year is the seventh, with about 50 tractors expected to take part. Money raised goes to Birmingham's Children's Hospital, your local air ambulance, and also Lens Light, which raises awareness of mental health issues in rural communities. "We have so much support from everyone, and most of the drivers do it every year," said farmer Martin Brandreth, a BBC Make a Difference Award winner and a member of the Sheepy Tractor Run. He said about 40 drivers return each year. Tractors are dressed in an array of festive lights and people are invited to line the route, details posted on social media. A group of tractors will also be on display at Atherston Market Square from about 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock after the Friday convoy has finished. Meanwhile, a charity which provides shoes to children is back in operation following a setback when a city retailer closed down. The Coventry Children's Boots Fund has been going since 1983, but its service was put under threat with the closure of the children's shoe section at one of its suppliers in December last year. The charity, which provides about 500 pairs of shoes per year, now has an agreement with shoe firm Clarks, which will accept vouchers issued by the organisation. Volunteer Janet McConkie, who has been given an MBE for her work, said the charity was really excited to be back in operation again. Families with children at schools in Coventry could ask for an application form, and once verified, the charity would then issue vouchers to eligible applicants. Since the previous supplier shut, they'd not been able to supply vouchers as there was nowhere to redeem them, she said. But now that Clarks has come on board, vouchers will be able to be issued even before Christmas.
The founder of a site dedicated to rescuing vulnerable trees has said she feels honoured to have provided a home to one of the first saplings grown from the illegally felled Sycamore Gap tree. The original sycamore, which stood in a dip next to Hadrian's Wall in Northumberland, was illegally chopped down in 2023. However, 49 saplings, known as Trees of Hope, have been grown by the National Trust from seeds of the original tree. One of the first was planted at the Tree Sanctuary in Coventry, and its co-founder, Martina Irwin, said she hoped as many people can enjoy the tree as possible. The site was set up 3 years ago by three teenagers who call themselves the Tree Amigos. They rescue trees that have been vandalised in Coventry, growing saplings from their seeds. The Tree of Hope sapling arrived in Coventry on Friday, and a camera was set up to keep an eye on it before it was planted on Saturday. Ms. Irwin said, in a wonderful turn of events, the first visitor to see it was a local fox. It has a spot on South Common, among other trees that we've rescued and replanted, she said. I'm so, so grateful, absolutely delighted that we've got this sapling. It means so much. It's the icing on the tallest cake in the world. Ms. Irwin said the loss of Sycamore Gap tree had brought home how important it was for the group to continue with their work. When the original tree was felled, the sanctuary planted 100 sycamore saplings from locally gathered seeds to create a living legacy. She described each of them as their own seeds of hope. Daniel Michael Graham, age 39, and Adam Caruthers, age 32, who chopped down the Sycamore Gap tree, were convicted of criminal damage and jailed in July.
People will be able to help with hedgerow planting and nominate places for trees to be planted over the coming months after a council was awarded cash to carry out the work. Warwickshire County Council have received nearly £36,500 from the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs through a fund operated by the Tree Council. Trees will be planted in the heart of communities, including urban streets, after they were requested by residents, the council said. Young trees will also be planted in green spaces, while existing hedgerows will be improved and new hedgerows will be planted to boost biodiversity. Councillor Darren Cheshire said, "Trees and hedgerows make our towns and villages more attractive places to live. They support local wildlife and they provide peaceful, calming environments that are proven to support people's well-being." He said the investment would help to ensure that future generations could continue to enjoy leafy Warwickshire. The Trees Outside Woodland scheme offers grants of up to £40,000 to councils and charities to grow trees on land that the public can use. Tree Council Chief Executive Officer Sarah Lom said, "Trees outside woodland are the trees we all come across most often. Those in our parks, on our streets, and even the hedgerows that act as heritage highways for a rich array of wildlife." She said cash awarded would benefit people, wildlife, and our planet. The council said people will be able to help plant hedgerows at Wrighton Pools Country Park. Details on how to get involved and how to nominate places to plant trees are to be published in the coming months.
Millions of people are still clinging to the old wives' tales when it comes to catching a cold, with many convinced drafty rooms and going outside with wet hair are to blame. A poll of 2,000 UK adults found more than a quarter believe you can catch a cold simply by being outside when the temperature drops, while 28% think stepping out with damp hair is directly linked to falling ill, and a further 22% reckon sitting in a drafty room will make you unwell. Yet, while 89% think it's important to support their immune system to keep colds at bay, as they feel, on average, under the weather, three times each winter, 22% admitted they have no idea of improving gut health can play a big part in doing so. Whether these figures should be taken as gospel may be questioned, as the research was commissioned by Yakult, which has teamed up with registered dietitian Lucy Kerrison to help bust some of the most common winter wellness myths. She said there are so many misconceptions about how our immune system works, often passed down through generations. Cold weather or damp air don't cause colds. Viruses do. However, during winter, we tend to spend more time indoors with others, which makes it easier for these viruses to spread. What can make a difference is keeping your immune system well supported, and that's where gut health and Yakult come in. She said to keep the gut and immune system working together effectively, diversity in the diet is key. Microbes in the gut feed on the fibre found in plant foods, so the more variety you eat, the broader the range of beneficial bacteria. This includes fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, seeds, legumes, and, to a lesser extent, herbs and spices. Science manager for Yakult, Dr. Holly Neal, said, "With so much health content online, it's easy to see why people get confused. Social media can make wellness trends sound simple or miraculous, but not everything you see is backed by science. In fact, blanket case recommendations, such as everyone should avoid gluten, or promises of quick fixes, are a red flag. Nutrition is nuanced, and there's no such thing as a silver bullet. Always look for advice from sources with recognised expertise and a strong scientific background. Supporting gut health doesn't need to be complicated. Simple, everyday choices can have a real positive impact over time."
Food, shelter, warmth and companionship are on offer this Christmas for people in Coventry who are homeless, lonely or vulnerable. Voluntary organisation Coventry Open Christmas will be open for 24 hours a day from December the 24th to the 29th at Queen's Road Baptist Church in the city centre. Anyone who needs a safe place to go is welcome, whether for a hot meal, a chat, overnight shelter or just to avoid being alone. Operations manager Natasha Lees said, "Coventry Open Christmas exists for one simple reason. No one in our city should have to face Christmas alone. For many of our guests, the holidays can be the hardest days of the year. A hot meal, a warm bed and, most importantly, a friendly conversation can make a world of difference. What is truly humbling is seeing how people transform when they feel safe and welcomed. You see shoulders relax, you hear laughter return, and you realise how powerful human connection really is. Our volunteers give their time freely, and the compassion they show is extraordinary. They turn a simple church hall into a place of belonging. This project proves what Coventry does best, look out for one another. And every donation, every hour volunteered, every shared smile helps ensure that this spirit reaches those who need it most." Coventry Open Christmas will also host a Christmas Day lunch at Baptist Church from 12 till 4 on Christmas Day. The charity is taking over the lunch event, which will no longer take place at the Methodist Church Hall as in previous years. Natasha added, "This will put extra financial burden on us, but we just cannot see people go without on Christmas Day. The charity is looking for volunteers who can help with serving food, chatting with guests, logistics and donation handling. A volunteer information evening takes place on Monday, the 1st of December at Queen's Road Baptist Church, starting at 7 p.m. Donations of cash, food, bedding, clothes and other items are welcome."
Land near a railway line that is home to rare butterflies but was damaged by a landslip is being restored by grazing sheep. The landslip near the Harbury Tunnel in 2015 caused major disruption and damaged the ground, Network Rail said. A team has restored the cutting and seeded the ground with meadow grasses and wildflowers to encourage pollinating insects. But because mowing the ground will be difficult and expensive, the sheep will graze it instead. The sheep will spend the winter on the cutting between Leamington Spa in Warwickshire and Banbury in Oxfordshire, grazing on the grasses and weeds that would compete with the newly planted meadow grasses and wildflowers. Engineers said a site of special scientific interest was also affected in February 2015. Network Rail teamed up with the Butterfly Conservation and a farmer to move the sheep onto the land. Mike Slater, chair of Butterfly Conservation Warwickshire Branch, said it was a fantastic project. "By managing this land in the right way, we have the opportunity to create the perfect habitat for five rare species of butterfly." He listed the five species as the small blue, the dark green fritillary, the grizzled skipper, dingy skipper, and green hairstreak. Simon Thatcher, assistant track safety engineer for Network Rail's Central Route, said the site had been a tricky challenge because of its location and ecology. He said the landslip had caused devastation and depleted the habitat, and this work would improve the ecology and the site. "We're really pleased that we've been able to come to this agreement and bring the sheep onto the cutting," he said. "They will be a welcome addition for both local wildlife and passing passengers."
With the success of the reopening of Kenilworth Railway Station, an MP has renewed calls for another disused station to be reopened. Stockingford Station on the outskirts of Nuneaton closed in 1968, and there's been a long campaign to get it brought back into use. Speaking in Parliament, Jodie Gosling, the MP for Nuneaton, said that reviving the station could be transformational for teams, fans and residents of Stockingford and Camp Hill and give a huge boost to local growth. The station is on the Birmingham to Leicester line, and the Transport Minister, Lillian Greenwood, replied that Warwickshire County Council would receive a grant of nearly £70 million to support local transport schemes. The local council had failed to attract funding to reopen the station in 2022, and Ms Gosling had asked what support could be offered to build on that business case. Ms Greenwood said her department would issue guidance later this year to support local authorities in deciding how best to use their grants.
Bird enthusiasts in Warwickshire are raising money to try to save some of the last remaining curlews in the area. Just a handful of breeding pairs of the wading birds, more commonly found on the west coast of the UK, can now be spotted around Tysoe and Knapton. They come to the area in early spring to nest and raise their young in grassy fields. The Banbury Ornithological Society said because they were ground nesting birds, they had been vulnerable to changes in farming practices, like cutting hay earlier and a rise in predation from foxes. In 2004, there were 25 breeding pairs recorded in Warwickshire, but this year's survey found that there are now just 5 pairs, all in the south of the county. Nationally, the species is now red-listed after a steep decline in population. Jan Gilbride, who is in charge of curlew recovery for the Banbury Society, said, "They are vulnerable to all of the predators that are around, so anything that likes to eat eggs or chicks will come and find them and try to eat them." She said that included foxes, badgers, buzzards and crows. The Trust for Oxfordshire's Environment and Wild Oxfordshire have teamed up to raise £50,000 to support curlew conservation in Warwickshire and the Upper Thames area. They have already managed to raise more than £25,000 and money will be matched by the BA Better World Community Fund and the Aviva Community Fund. It will be spent on fencing off areas of land to protect the birds from foxes and to pay farmers to leave any fields where nests are found for longer before the hay is cut to allow the chicks to hide from buzzards. Musgill Bride said, "There's lots of different ways we can do in terms of recruiting volunteers and training them and helping them." She said they would look to rent land from farmers, which would be fenced off. But she said we can't just expect the farmers to just pay for all of that themselves. So the Curlew Partnership, led by Wild Oxfordshire, said over the past 5 years it had protected 110 nests using temporary electric fencing, resulting in 74% hatching success rate, compared to the national average of only 25%. Campaign volunteer Rosemary Collier said, "We are rapidly running out of time to keep this iconic species in our county. We want generations to come to hear the amazing sound of the curlew across the meadowlands and wetlands of Warwickshire."
Outlook News.
Thanks to our readers, Peter and Elaine. Before moving on, I've got some lighting up times this week for you. 4:01 p.m. to 7:30 a.m. Must be about the longest night at the moment, or coming along. Anyway, we're moving on to Hugh with this week's news from the centre.
Thank you very much. I think we've got another month to go before we get to the longest night, and then it'll be right. Lighting up time, 3:15 p.m. and then to about
8,
or 2:30. Well, we're just about to embark on our winter warmer this weekend. So if you're listening before the weekend, we hope to see you there. I'll be cooking up a storm with pork and stuffing batches, and of course the famous soup. We had some students in yesterday afternoon, medical students. They come in for a little chat from me, and they've just been out to see a couple of people who I put them in contact with, and anyway they came back saying, "Oh yes, we've heard about your soup." And it was like eight students who were. Anyway, so it's famous. That's what I wanted to say. So you need to come and try it. We've got lots of stalls and stuff happening as well. The shop will be open. And, of course, we've got the children's choir coming from Earlston Primary School. And they'll be performing for us at about 1:15 on the stairs. They liked that last year. Not quite so many last year, this year as last, I'm pleased to say, because we were kind of squished in a bit. We are going to have all the stalls and everything in the Mary Beale Room this year, trying to spread it out a little bit because it was a little tight last year. So we will be spreading out the cafe, which this year will be called Rosie's Cozy Cafe, which is how Rosie wanted the when we do get a permanent cafe here, that's what she wants it to be called, and of course it will be called that. But anyway, we're going to have a little nod to that, so Rosie's Cozy Cafe will be in full operation as well. We've got Tombola, and of course we have the raffle. Now, I mentioned this last week, we have some lovely tickets now for our winter raffle. The first prize is a fantastic Christmas hamper, which will be available to view on Saturday. Lots of lovely stuff in there. Second prize is going to be Coventry Blaze tickets, and then we've got other prizes of tickets for the rugby and some really nice bottles and a few other stuff as well. So tickets are £1 a pop. You can buy a whole book of five for £5. They're all available at the reception. They will be available, of course, on Saturday. We'll be selling these right up until the 17th of December, and the draw will be taking place on this very programme on Wednesday the 17th of December, and we will be picking out the winners. And The reason we'll do that is that I can then hightail it off and we'll let people know what their prizes are and make sure that they get them before Christmas, especially the Christmas hamper. Now, on the 13th of December, there is a trip to the Coventry Christmas Market, which Chris and Claire are organising. So it'll be getting the bus or picked up in the bus and taken down to the city centre. I think you get dropped off at Pool Meadow or anything, and you walk up the hill. And the Coventry Christmas Market is taking place in Broadgate. So Chris and Claire went and did a risk assessment. They decided the slope up to the the Ferris wheel is a bit dangerous, but you can take your life in your hands if you want to on that. But otherwise, it all looks like fantastic. There are plenty of spaces left for that if you want to go. I cannot remember off the top of my head what the costs were, but it'll be minibus plus a few things plus whatever your spending money is. Yes, I do remember it. So it's £13 to include bus. There'll be volunteers there as well to guide you around. Anyway, it'd be a nice afternoon at the Christmas market. It's a Saturday, the 13th of December. We also have on the 3rd of February next year is the trip to Tommy. It's definitely on the 3rd of February, which is the Tuesday. So if you would like to sign up for that, we've got a lot of people coming on it already, but there's still a bit of space. If you'd like to sign up and come to that, we'll do a touch tour. We'll have fish and chips here first, then go and do the touch tour and then stay for the show. If you don't know Tommy, it's a rock opera, and Pinball Wizard is the big 11 o'clock number in that one, and it looks like it's going to be quite a lot of fun. Still time to sign up for that. Now, I've mentioned this before, but obviously we do a lot of exercise here now at the Hub, and that's been something that's developed a lot over the last couple of years, and I think it's been greatly appreciated. Certainly, you know, the walks and the various physical activities that we provide are well subscribed. The newest one is physical training, so this is really quite intense physical exercise that happens on Wednesdays, we're finding that the classes are a little light and we'd like a few more people. So in order to combat that, Sophie, who runs the class, she has offered to do a free taster session, which is going to be on Wednesday, the 7th of January. Wednesday, the 7th of January. So that's the first Wednesday that we're back after the new year. So if you would, in fact, I think it's the first Wednesday of the new year. If you would like to take part in that, please do let reception know. In fact, let Chris know and he'll keep a list. So rather than running through to reception, though you can tell reception, but you know, basically Chris is the person who needs to know. So get in there. You will still need to have what's called a Parcue form completed. So this is just some basic health details for Sophie, the instructor, to have a look at to make sure that what she does isn't going to kill you. Essentially, that's the rule.
Subtle.
Well, I'm subtle. Yes, that's me. Subtle as a brick, as I'm often told by my family. I picked up a bit of news today, which I didn't know. Actually, it is a month or so old. But RNIB is getting a brand new CEO. A chap called Simon Antrobus, who's replacing Matt Stringer. Now, I know Matt Stringer. I've met him a few times at the Visionary Conference. Visionary is the organisation that supports charities like us. RNIB is sort of an associate member of that. Obviously, they are enormous, RNIB, and they have oodles of money, far, far more than we do. We all have our criticisms, I think, of RNIB in terms of how they operate in dealing with local charities. They do some most wonderful things as well that some of you will know about, like the Talking Library and their legal advice service and various other things, their information booklets and all that sort of stuff. So Simon Antrobus, who was the CEO of Children in Need, is coming on board early in the new year, and we're looking forward very much to working with him and hope that he will recognise or try and work out how RNIB can best support the organisations that are truly on the ground and helping people who are blind or partially sighted. Yes, and so short and sweet, I think, this week. I think I've rattled through that far more, and I haven't waffled quite as much as I usually do.
Well, there's a lot in there. Yes. Thanks very much for that.
Thank you.
Here's Sarah with this week's sport.
I'm back. Yes, hello, lovely, lovely listeners. And apologies again for not being able to record last week, but I was rather busy on the Saturday, which of course is the main day that all the sport happens. So what's been going on in the fortnight since I last spoke to you all? Well, in football, we had the international break with the final matches in the World Cup qualifier. Well, England beat Serbia at home and Albania away, both by 2-0, but it could have been so many more. But they'd already qualified, so Thomas de Tuchel was trying out different combinations, some of which worked, some of which didn't really, and I'll leave it at that. Meanwhile, in Scotland's final qualifying match, they faced Denmark, knowing that they had to win in order to qualify of right. Well, they scored first and excitement was high in Glasgow. But then Denmark equalised 1-1. Then Scotland scored again, 2-1. Then Denmark equalised 2-2. And so it remained going into extra time. But then Scotland scored again. And while the fans were still celebrating, they scored again. So Scotland, along with England, are automatically on that plane, though probably separate ones, heading for America, Mexico and Canada next summer. Meanwhile, Wales, in their final qualifying match, thrashed North Macedonia 7-1. This now means that Wales are in the final qualifying rounds, along also with Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. So the British Isles could have 5 teams going off to that World Cup. Wow, wow, wow. I think sport would need to be about an hour long if that happened. There were 3 City players involved in the World Cup qualifiers and friendlies. Hadji Wright plays for America, the USA, who of course have already qualified by Wright being one of the co-hosts. Brandon Thomas Asante now plays for Ghana. And Jada Silva plays for Wales and was on the pitch for most, if not all, of the match against North Macedonia. So, back to home. What about the City? Well, on Saturday we faced West Brom, West Bromwich Albion, to give them their full name. And it was a 12:30 kick-off because it was televised. Oh, the odds weren't good. To make it worse, we hadn't won 2 consecutive matches against West Brom since 1985. And yes, we did win the last one. And to make it even worse, Frank Lampard had got the kiss of death when he was named Manager of the Month last month. And you know what that means? Yep, it means turn of fate for your team. So, the match started. And yes, after 9 minutes, it went true to that form when they had the audacity to score. And they scored again. A bit further on in the first half, City fans just didn't know how to react. For the first time this season, we were 2-0 down. Fortunately, Josh Eccles managed to restore a little bit of decency to the scoreline and made it 2-1 just before half time. So that's how it was at half time, 2-1 down. But then, in the second half, it took a bit of a turn of fate, because one of the West Brom players, who'd already been booked in the first half for mouthing off and generally being a right silly boy, was booked again for the same offence. I mean, Steve Agrizovich had said that the West Brom manager should have substituted him. He actually said that before the second booking, because the player apparently lives on a very short fuse. Anyway, Mr. Sims, Ellis no doubt, who plays for City, took full advantage of that and headed the ball goalwards. Goal! City 2-2. Oh well, a draw is better than what we seem to be facing a bit earlier on. But then, in the 71st minute, Victor Torp fired one of his long, hard, fast torpedo shots into that goal. City had come from 2-0 down to lead 3-2. Now that was the final score. So it was yet another victory. It's hard to say enough about this City team at the moment. At the time of recording, we are top of the league by 7 points, ahead of Middlesbrough in second, and Stoke City are 10 points behind us. We also have a goal difference of an amazing 28, compared, for example, with Middlesbrough, whose goal difference is 6. City were definitely a different side in the second half. I don't know what Frank Lampard said to them in the half-time talk, but you could certainly bottle it and sell it for a profit. Now, they will have played a match by the time you're listening to this, because we are away to Middlesbrough on Tuesday night. But then, we're at home next Saturday, so that's Saturday the 29th. We're playing Charlton, who were thumped 5-1 at the weekend by Southampton. And it's a 3 p.m. kick-off. So what's your excuse for not going to the winter warmer and then going home, putting your feet up, putting the radio on and getting a bit of hopefully heartwarming listening to our City? And now, just to catch up on local league, non-league football, well, the two teams that I cover each week. Leamington, who haven't been doing very well, I'm afraid, and are now firmly bottom of their division, travelled to Wales to play Chester. Yes, I know Chester is in England, but their ground is in Wales. Mm-hmm. Okay, anyway, I'm afraid Leamington had yet another loss, losing 2-0. Meanwhile, Stratford entertained Leighton and won 2-1. So well done, Stratford. Looking good. You've won your last two matches. And now a total change of tone. Cricket. Well, down under, it's the beginning of the Ashes series. Now, the Ashes is a real grudge match between England and Australia. Yeah. Anyway, the first match was played at a new ground in Perth. And I'm going to sum this up like a school report. England batted first. Now, I'm going to give England a D for their performance. But then I'm going to give Australia a D minus for their performance in their first innings. Both innings were almost over bar the last Australian wicket in one day. So what of day two with the second innings? Well, I'm afraid England got another D. But Australia, unfortunately, got a B plus. Could have been more, but they only had to get to 205, which they reached with 8 wickets remaining. So the 5-day test, had lasted 2 days. Just feel sorry for those people who got tickets for the 3rd, 4th, or 5th day, especially if they travelled to Australia. Now, the F1. Well, the merry-go-round alighted yesterday, I'm recording on Monday, in Las Vegas. Now, I didn't actually watch or listen to this Grand Prix, because I'd heard that it was at 4 o'clock, and I'd assumed 4 p.m., whereas it was actually a 4 a.m. start. And to be truthful, even if I had heard that it was a 4 a.m. start, I wouldn't have watched or listened to it at that time. I have my beauty sleep to catch up on, and my God, I need a lot of beauty sleep. Anyway, going into this Grand Prix, there were 3 left, and Lando Norris leads. He's at the top of the Drivers' Championship, with Oscar Piastri 2nd and Max Verstappen 3rd. And it looked even better before the race because Lando was in pole position. So I'm going to give you the results now. 1st, Max Verstappen. 2nd, George Russell. And 3rd, Kimi Antonelli. Unfortunately, both Lando and Oscar were disqualified. After the race, they were found to have millimetres too small skid blocks. Now, I don't really understand the insides of a racing car, or any car for that matter, but I understand there was a lot of smoking from the skid blocks after the race had finished, and it was that drew the stewards' attention to them, and when they measured them, they were too small. So going into the next Grand Prix, which is the penultimate, Orlando has a 24-point lead, and statistically, if he beats Max Verstappen and Oscar Piastri, who are now tied by 2 points, he has to beat them by a 2-point margin, he's won the title. Simple. Well, what will be. Anyway, what I do know is that the next Grand Prix is in Qatar, and it's on Sunday the 30th of November, and again they're saying 4 p.m. So hopefully it will be. And finally, now, there's a little short, very short cycle race in Somerset. It's only 179 metres, and it's divided into 3 groups for competitors: children, adult, shall we say, fun cyclists, many of whom compete in fancy dress, and 20 serious elite cyclists. 2 things about this 179-metre course, well, 3 actually. Firstly, it is very steep. To see it on the television, it equates roughly to Hilltop, for those of you who know Coventry and Hilltop. And secondly, it is very narrow, though just probably slightly wider than Hilltop. And thirdly, like Hilltop, it is all cobbles and quite uneven. And so what is the name of this cycle race? The Cobble Wobble, of course. Oh, not to my liking, I'm afraid. Anyway, that has been your sport for this week. Oh, just to say that Coventry Rugby weren't playing this week, so that's why I didn't cover them. Okay, lovely, lovely listeners, now you all go and have a great week, and I hope to see you at the Winter Warmer. Bye!
Thanks to Sarah for this week's sport. Here's Dave Monks with Postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there, and welcome to your Postbag. Now, what are we going to talk about? Are you starting to get ready for Christmas? Please start sending your Christmas greetings, songs, poetry, Christmas jokes, etc. for Postbag. More especially your messages, to arrive in time for me to compile them for the festive edition of Outlook. When I was starting compiling and presenting Postbag, a letter came in once at Christmas time saying that it was from a lady whose brother she lived with had died. She tried switching on the radio, but there was a lot of forced jollity and didn't do anything for her. Then her copy of Outlook arrived, and there was messages offering genuine friendship. Another message said that we catered for the forgotten people. There are still forgotten people out there who feel isolated and lonely, particularly at Christmas. Let's reach out to them. Say hello to them. Wish them a happy Christmas. This week, we hear part two of the creative writing piece from Derek Headley, the swimmer. Last week's school swimming champion, Johnny, was inspired by an item on TV about sea swimming. A month later, on a beach holiday, Johnny, having persuaded the parents to stay behind on the beach, walked into the cold sea. Johnny first walked and then waded into the sea. When he was submerged to his waist, he fully submerged himself in order to acclimatise to the sea. Johnny filled his lungs and began to swim. To his surprise, the effect was not instant. Rather, it was a slow process that crept up on him. First, he felt a peaceful isolation. Then, with each stroke, the burdens slowly detached themselves from his shoulders. Finally, he was burden-free, not a care in the world, an overwhelming feeling of happiness. Even in this state of euphoria, Johnny sensed something was amiss. The sea seemed choppier, and the wind was getting up. Johnny started to tread water to get his bearings, only to discover he was a long way past the buoys, and the current was pulling him further and further out to sea. As he swam towards the shore, Johnny was becoming more and more anxious. Now the waves in front of him were getting larger, and dark clouds were rolling in. Rapidly, his anxiety turned to being fully scared. His mind was full of one thought: Dad, Mum, help me. Crash! A huge wave broke on his back, sending him deep below the surface, disorientating it. It was instinct, survival, and fear that drove him back to the surface. As Johnny broke the surface, gulping for air, he managed to say, "Help!" Crash! Another wave had sent him under. Johnny's Herculean strength and endless stamina, which he was renowned for in the swimming pool, was seeping from his body at an alarming, ludicrous rate. The immense, furious power the sea could unleash was becoming far too clear. far too real for Johnny. This time when he broke the surface, time seemed to slow down. There was a flash of lightning and Johnny saw a figure on horseback, a deep black stallion galloping down the side of a huge wave towards him. Between gulping for air, Johnny managed to utter, "Help me, please." After going under again, with just his hand breaking the surface, Johnny felt something warm grasp it. The drag, to drag him from the sea as if he was as weightless as a feather. Mounted behind the figure, feeling the heat from the black horse and the figure, Johnny looking back over his shoulder to see the watery grave he had been rescued from. He now wants to laugh with his fellow riders at cheating death. However, what Johnny saw was two crew members of the lifeboat dragging his body from the sea. Turning to face a direction, the mount was galloping full pelt across the waves and towards Watt. Johnny saw a magnificent, all-consuming bright light. At once, Johnny felt safe. At once, Johnny felt totally unburdened, as he knew he would never feel fear again. Despite this knowledge, Johnny screamed, "Please, I don't want to die!" As the words left his mouth, quick as a flash, Johnny found himself on the lifeboat, coughing up large volumes of salty seawater. By Derek Headley. Thank you, Derek. Have you ever been swimming in the sea, lake or river? Or how about a swimming bath? Jag Singh says how helpful people were at the wave with his visual impairment recently. Let's have your experiences. Now, did you commemorate Armistice Day or Remembrance Sunday? Elizabeth went to the lake at Barston with a two-course meal, 40 style, and a cabaret by two of the D-Day darlings, dressed in RAF Royal Air Force uniforms. One of whom, Emily, comes in to entertain at the Monday Club from time to time, with her mum, musical singer Elizabeth. Here's our Elizabeth, from the Monday Club, to tell you all about it.
Hi everyone. This week's roving report comes from a super dinner and dance which we attended in honour of Armistice Day. At the lake at Barston, we enjoyed a super walk around the lake initially. That whet our appetite for the sumptuous meal which followed. The afternoon was rounded off nicely, dancing to the D-Day Darlings, two gorgeous young ladies.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It's great of you to do reports of Postbag, and he sounds smashing too. The fixed 1940s meal and the D-Day Darlings was a lunchtime show. They do have some great tribute nights in the evening at the lake at Barston. Tell us where you've been lately. Have you been to any shows? Tell us about them. And I was listening to In Touch early on Sunday morning recently on Radio 4, and they were talking about taxis taking guide dogs. App-based Uber says they have a strict code insisting that drivers take guide dogs. I normally use Bolt when I feel like a bit of comfort, which tend to be cheaper than most taxis. But they do offer a choice of taxis if you feel you need a larger vehicle. What's your experience with taxis? The other subject on In Touch was that a television company called Love Productions are looking for visually impaired bakers for a program called Bake Off. The deadline is December the 16th. And talking about In Touch, have you any thoughts about the BBC? Well, you must have heard the news. But do you enjoy the programmes? Do you trust the news? Is it still worth the licence fee? Okay. Right, thank you very much. That's about all from Postbag this week. I don't have any more for you at the moment, but we can play it next week if some come in a bit late. So thank you very much for your comments this week, and please let's have your Christmas greetings especially, and other comments as well about items arising from this copy of Outlook or any other thing. Helpful tips would be nice. Okay, you can ring us up on 024 76 717 522 and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper, or any other way you feel happiest. Thank you very much, and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's all from Postbag for this week. Keep your contributions coming. Our Warwickshire Wonder this week takes us to the South Warwickshire village of Oxhill in the Vale of the Red Horse. Its church, dedicated to St Lawrence, has some fascinating historical features, notably marks on the chancel window mullions believed to have been made by archers sharpening their arrowheads, and in its churchyard a 1705 headstone for Mertilla, among the earliest known graves of an African slave in England.
Oxhill is a name which suggests oxen on a hill, but it actually means a ledge of land or a hill. In the Domesday Book, where a mill is recorded, it is spelt Octoselve. In 1183, Robert de Stafford granted the monks of Bordersley 12 acres of land on the torrent or stream of Oxhill, where my ox herds dwell. It would appear that the connection with the oxen was brought about as a result of changes in the spelling. All very confusing. At one end of the main street is the village hall, originally a board school, opened in 1876 and closed after the Second World War, since when Oxhill children have travelled to school in neighbouring Tyso. There is an attractive inn, the Peacock, and further along is the Methodist Church, built in 1812 and extended in 1839. 2 years later, the Sunday School was started, and in 1880 there were celebrations for the centenary of Robert Raikes having founded the first Sunday School in Gloucester. At the head of the street is the old church of St Lawrence. There are the remains of a preaching cross near to the north door. The building still retains its original doorways and chancel arch, dating from the mid-12th century. A priest's doorway is probably 14th century, and a 12th century font has curious carvings of Adam and Eve. Not to be missed at the west end of the church are 6 15th century oak benches and a fine screen to the tower, originally forming part of a 15th century chancel screen. In the churchyard, southeast of the church, there is a most interesting little headstone. The inscription is as follows: "Here lieth Mertilla, Negro body slave to Mr. Thomas Beauchamp, gent, of Nevis, baptised October ye 26th, and buried ye January the 6th, 1705. Mr. Thomas Beauchamp is believed to have been a sugar planter, which would explain this neat headstone, so unexpected in an English village, and which says a lot about the character of the man, Mr. Thomas Beauchamp."
Next up, the second part of a two-part study of the insect kingdom's extraordinary achievers, ants. And this is read by Nigel.
After a winter of hibernation in their relatively cosy nests, wood ants are active from spring to October. appearing from around March when the weather warms up and the risk of regular frosts has passed. They often swarm across the nest in sunny weather to warm themselves, and this activity may be audible to anyone standing nearby. Males are likely to emerge first and then disperse to reduce the risk of mating with queens from their own nests. When this happens, it's dependent on the weather and varies throughout the country. A newly emerged queen will fly out to seek a mate, soon after which she will lose her wings and start the process of laying eggs in her chosen nest, either the one from which she has emerged or a new one. She will lay thousands of eggs each year, and the speed of ongoing development is dependent on the conditions. When the larvae or grubs hatch, they are fed with a regurgitated, protein-rich liquid. In due course, the larvae spin cocoons, and the workers continue to care for them through the pupal stage. When the new ants are ready to emerge, the workers cut open the cocoons. Throughout the egg, larval and pupal stages, the workers care for the brood and may relocate them to warmer parts of the nest to speed development. It has also recently been discovered that ants at the pupal stage produce a milk-like substance that nourishes both ants and larvae. Whether the emerging ant is a male, a female worker or a queen depends on the diet it received at its larval stage, and whether or not the egg has been fertilised. Wood ants play an important role in woodland ecology. They are omnivorous and enjoy a diet that varies with the availability of prey species, consuming a variety of invertebrates such as aphids, spiders, caterpillars and even other ants. Seeds form a small proportion of their diet, as does tree sap and the juice of berries. They also scavenge on dead invertebrates. The worker ants subdue their hapless prey by biting and spraying it with formic acid from a gland at the rear of the abdomen. The ants can swing their abdomen round to aim at the target. This acid may travel several centimetres and penetrates the skin of the prey, paralysing it and damaging tissues. Several ants may work together to carry heavy prey, and sometimes they cut up their victims before moving the booty back to the nest, where it may be eaten or fed in regurgitated form to the larvae. Wood ants also obtain food by milking aphids, which feed on tree sap and secrete a substance known as honeydew, which the ants like and make the most of by moving aphids to optimal spots where they can produce the honeydew. In return, the ants protect them from predators. Another interspecies relationship can exist between wood ants and some birds. Jays, for instance, encourage them beneath their wings, where the ants' squirting of formic acid caused by this rude disturbance helps to keep mites at bay. Wood ants' activity is a crucial and intriguing part of a woodland ecosystem. Their nest building aids soil aeration, and their utilisation of organic matter in the nest improves soil quality, and an increase of mineral nutrient being made available to plants. Additionally, the nests are home to more than just wood ants, with several other creatures being found only in wood ants' mounds. Their love of honeydew demonstrates the wood ants' taste for sweetness, and some plants capitalise on this by producing a sweet coating on their seeds which is palatable to the ants, and thus seed dispersal is facilitated. Ants' predation on invertebrates such as moth caterpillars regulates the insect populations that might negatively impact tree health, and the ants themselves are part of the woodland feed chain. Green woodpeckers love them, although the workers' ants may spray the birds with formic acid to deter them. Mammals such as badgers and pine martins also eat ants. It's a wonderful woodland-wide web of life which aids the health of the environment as a whole. Unfortunately, it's not all good news for the wood ant. They are not legally protected in the UK, and although they are found across the country, their range is reducing. The southern wood ant is listed as near threatened on the Global International Union for the Conservation of Nature Red List. It has disappeared from some parts of northern England, North Wales and the Midlands. Decline is due to habitat loss caused by changes in woodland management and by deforestation, to name but two man-made issues that impact the ant's survival. Woodland fragmentation poses a significant threat, as these ants need large areas of well-connected habitat in order to flourish. Tracts of woodland need to be within 219 yards of each other so that colonies can grow naturally. If a colony cannot expand through the woodland, it reduces the ant's adaptability to changes in habitat, food availability and resources. However, humanity can right the wrong, and informed conservation measures help, of course. In 2019 and 2021, a relocation project was undertaken in Hertfordshire, relocating the red wood ant nest to a country park. The charity Rewilding Britain says on its website that reintroduction projects like these play a vital role in rewilding woods and restoring essential ecological processes across Britain. It is to be hoped that such sensitive management can continue wherever it is necessary, that these tiny but astonishingly well-organised creatures, who could probably teach us a thing or two about teamwork, will be able to thrive, to continue the natural conservation work at which they are so very adept.
Talking of great achievers, the world's top-selling living author, Lee Child, who was born in Coventry, talks about his early life to Gary Bushell of the Daily Express. This is read by Margaret.
He may have become one of the world's most successful authors, but Lee Child's early life was scarred by violence. Coventry-born Child, real name Jim Grant, had a tough Birmingham upbringing. A bright boy, he won a place on academic merit to King Edward's, then a direct grant grammar school. My parents were boring, but they pushed us to do well at school, which puts a target on your back at 11, going to a posh school in Edgbaston, Lee, 70, tells me. Getting to school and back meant two fights a day, minimum, until we were teenagers. Nicknamed Grievous at school, Grant started writing after losing his Granada TV job in 1994. His choice of pen name was Shrewd. On bookshop shelves, Child was a perfect fit between Chandler and Christie. His first Reacher novel, 1997's Killing Floor, established his itinerant crime fighter as a modern-day knight errant wandering the USA, standing up to injustice and levelling the odds for the little guy. Since then, his fictional ex-military cop has conquered the world. More than 200 million Reacher books have sold across 101 countries in the last 28 years. Reacher is basically me when I was nine, he says. Everything was settled by violence. It was a ridiculous, toxic masculinity thing where you can't indulge your emotions. At 6'4", Child is an inch shorter than his creation and 5 stones lighter, but possessed of the same inner steel. Living in New York in the late 90s, when he saw an obnoxious drunk abuse a small Sikh taxi driver, he raced to the cabbie's aid. The drunk punched him in the face. "I beat the out of him," he admits. Lee is gaunt but healthy, despite smoking for 60 years, with a jaw like a blacksmith's anvil. You could hang a kettle off my chin. He's also sharp, lucid and candid. Gangs were rife growing up near Handsworth Park. It was like a no man's land, he said. But as you enter your teens, you're looking for identity. It's more of a cultural community than a gang. He found his through music. Hearing the Beatles' She Loves You, aged 8, was transformative. It was August the 23rd, 1963.
I was depressed. I was in a boring family with a boring life. The Midlands post-war were as dead as a doornail. All the glory was in the past. Hearing that opening 11 seconds of chorus was like the sun coming out. It was joy, happiness, frivolity, energy. It changed my life. He progressed through the Stones to Cream and then worked backwards to the blues that Rita adores via John Mayall's Blues Breakers and Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac. Later two-tone, local reggae band Steel Pulse and the UB40 floated his boat. After studying law at Sheffield University, Lee joined Granada TV as a trainee in 1977, becoming one of five studio directors. His new Manchester friends included Tony Wilson of Hacienda fame. He was a shop steward in the MUJ and I was a shop steward in the Technicians Union. All his TV backroom work was live and fraught with challenges. On May the 5th, 1980, the SAS were about to end the Iranian embassy siege. It was a bank holiday and the senior guy was shagging someone in the car park, so I had to handle that newsflash request. We were transmitting Coronation Street and they wanted to cut the news, but I wouldn't let them. I think the SAS were watching because as soon as we hit the end credits, in they went. It was the longest news flash in British TV history. Sharing canteens with Coronation Street actors was surreal. They weren't paid that much then, but culturally they were big stars. Geoffrey Hughes, who played Eddie Yates, dropped in for coffee regularly. Sacked after 18 years of service by Granada TV, as Lee wrote Killing Floor at his dining room table, naming the villains after the managers who fired him.
Celebrating the winter solstice on December the 21st, and this is the first of a selection of English customs and sticky stories taken from This England magazine and read by Elaine.
The winter solstice. This December, thousands will gather at Stonehenge for the winter solstice, with a free live stream available on YouTube, so people worldwide can watch the sunrise on the shortest day of the year. Whether you brave the cold to stand among the stones or watch from the warmth of your home, there's something deeply moving about this annual ritual. For thousands of years, our ancestors have gathered here to mark the turning of the year, to find hope in the knowledge that after the darkest day, the light will return. In our modern world of artificial light and climate control, it's easy to forget how profound the changing seasons once were to daily life. The winter solstice reminds us of that ancient rhythm, connecting us to countless generations who stood in the same spot, watching the same sunrise, hoping for spring's return. A sticky situation. When Yorkshire lorry driver Nathan Rimmington got a craving for gummy sweets, he did what any sensible person would do, ordered 3 kilograms of Haribo cola bottles from Amazon. What happened next, however, was far from sensible. Nathan proceeded to devour the entire container in just 3 days. That's over 10,000 calories worth of gelatinous treats. Shortly after his gummy marathon, the 33-year-old found himself rushed to hospital with severe abdominal pain, sweating, high blood pressure, and cold sweats. Initially suspecting food poisoning, doctors were baffled until tests revealed unusually high levels of gelatin in his digestive tract. The diagnosis? Acute diverticulitis caused by an excess of the stuff that makes gummy sweets gummy. While we admire Nathan's commitment to satisfying a sweet tooth, we can't help but think this is a cautionary tale about the perils of online shopping in the small hours. After all, Nobody needs 3 kilogram of Haribo, no matter how convincing those late night cravings might be. Perhaps next time Nathan will stick to a more modest 100-gram bag from the shop, though we suspect he might be put off for life. A Straordinary Spectacle. Every January, the Cambridgeshire town of Whittlesea plays host to one of England's most peculiar traditions. A man dressed entirely in straw, parading through the streets like a walking haystack. Welcome to the Straw Bear Festival, a 3-day celebration of agricultural oddity that dates back over 200 years. The custom originated on the Tuesday following Plough Monday, when a ploughman would don a costume made entirely of straw and entertain the townspeople in exchange for money, beer and food. The tradition was banned in the early 1900s, presumably by someone with no sense of fun, but was revived in 1980 and has been going strong ever since. These days the festival has expanded, with hundreds of folk dancers and musicians accompanying the straw-clad performer through the town. The weekend culminates with the ceremonial burning of the bear costume on Sunday evening, hopefully with the person safely watching it from the sidelines. And a petrifying discovery. Tucked away in Knaresborough, North Yorkshire, lies one of England's oldest visitor attractions, Mother Shipton's Cave and the Petrifying Well. The cave is said to be the birthplace of Yorkshire's famous prophetess, Mother Shipton. But it's the well next door that truly captures the imagination. The Petrifying Well is a geological oddity, where the water appears to turn objects to stone, as if by magic. Visitors over the centuries have hung everything from teddy bears to top hats beneath the cascading water, watching as mineral deposits gradually encrust them, creating an eerie stony shell. The process takes months, but the results are genuinely remarkable. The phenomenon is, of course, entirely scientific, rather than magical. The water is rich in minerals, which over time coat whatever hangs in its path. But knowing the science behind it doesn't make it any less fascinating to witness everyday objects transformed into what look like ancient relics. Said to have been attracting visitors since 1630, the site remains a unique remnant of the Royal Forest of Knaresborough. We think there's something rather wonderful about a 400-year-old tourist attraction that still manages to enchant modern visitors. In an age of virtual reality and digital experiences, there's something deeply satisfying about a phenomenon you can actually see and touch and take home if you're willing to wait a few months.
We locals know all about Kenilworth and Warwick Castles, both among the finest in England, but how about Bagot's Castle in Baggington, which stands on a bluff overlooking the River Sow? Dave Monks explores a much less well-known relic of the area's medieval history.
I'm in Bagot's Castle on a very windy day, and Bagot's is where they get the name Baggington from, right?
Yes, that's right. That's been here a long time. And the castle is in ruins, and I don't know if you've been down there before.
A long time ago.
Yeah, so you can go down there and see it now. It's all been sort of tidied up and safe walking around, and then you get to the river and to see the Old River, the River Walk. I don't know if you know, here used to be a village.
It did?
Yes, there used to be a village here.
Okay. How old is Bagot's Castle?
We have the details here. Do you know how old it is? Exactly.
So the original castle was a Norman one. Yeah. So like 1100. That was like a modern Bailey where they just made mounds and stuck on top. The one that's there now, that was William Bagot, who was Richard II's crony.
Ah,
so it's built about 1380, something like that.
Now, talking about Richard II, now there was a duel on Gosford Green that didn't take place.
Yeah.
I mean, Richard II called it off and banished them both. Thomas Mowbray stayed at Caledon Castle.
Bolingbroke was at Kenilworth Castle.
Yeah.
Because his dad was John of Gaunt and they owned Kenilworth Castle.
Yeah.
And Richard II stayed here.
Did he?
Yeah.
So he stayed here and helped him.
Yeah, which is quite strange to think that the king stayed here.
That's good.
At this place. And then the other famous one about the time was Henry Hotspur from Shakespeare and all that. He was imprisoned here in 1400-something.
Yeah.
Because by then Henry IV had taken over, and Hotspur's dad, the Earl of Northumberland, led the uprising against Henry IV.
Yeah.
And I think it was the Battle of Shrewsbury. Hotspur, he was like the leading icon of the day, got captured, and he was kept here for a bit.
Yeah.
And I think he was then moved to Coventry or somewhere because it was a bit more secure, but it was his staging post. So like those were like the two most famous visitors, was Harry Hotspur and Richard II.
Excellent.
William Bagot he was fairly sly. He wasn't actually that nice particularly, but he kept in with both sides. So at the same time he was mates with Richard II, he was sending letters to Bolingbroke and John of Gaunt.
Yeah.
So they knew that if they came to power then he would support them.
Yeah.
So in the, I think it's Richard II, the Shakespeare one, it has a lot of this. And in the Shakespeare play there's three of them of Richard II's cronies get and their head chopped off. But Bagot was given time slithered away to Ireland for a bit.
They did,
and then he came back when the heat had died down.
That's sensible,
But I think because he's just such an able person, just everyone in government wanted him on their team, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he was interesting kind of character.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So is Bagot's Castle haunted? I've heard it is.
I don't know.
No, you don't.
Have you heard of any hauntings?
That's the sort of story you told.
Yeah.
You have to tell the story about and asserted that people came to test for the ghosts.
Okay.
And they spoke to someone. Did I understand you right?
They attempted to talk to David Hewer, who was the recent custodian who helped get the place back in shape, but they didn't manage to contact him. It's on YouTube. They are the Rugby Ghost Hunters, they call themselves, and they didn't manage to contact David's spirit, but then they apparently did manage to contact the spirit of William Bagot.
And
he told them to leave was the one word that was heard on the recording, so he told them to clear off.
But we are going to brave the storm, aren't we, Elizabeth? Now, these are Bagot's goats. And the legend says the ancestors of these goats were brought back from the Crusades by Richard the Lionheart in the 12th century. But definitely they were given to Lord Bagot by Richard II in the 1390s. Okay.
Oh, wow.
This is where the medieval village was, in this big field to our left. Okay, so you've lived around here for a long time, but you haven't seen Bagot's Castle in Baggington.
Very embarrassing.
Never mind. It's nice to see it now, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's carvings of hares around here with the big long ears.
Oh.
Excellent. Presumably from tree stumps. Well, the wall here is about 8 foot high, perhaps.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, within the south wall of the castle, there are two rectangular drainage chutes, which would have served garderobes or toilets on the upper floors. these would have been discharged into the castle ditch, which fell away to the south.
The ditch would originally have been much deeper than it is now. There is a rectangular foundation over a drain. They would have had fires there, fireplace.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They would have tried to keep warm somehow in this drafty castle, yeah.
Yeah.
Because of the wet conditions due to the storm, Elizabeth, member of the Monday Club and listener to Outlook, and myself didn't go down the slope with a rope rail on either side, leading to the Bluebell Wood, the riverside walk and the tank training ground used by the Elvis. We thought we'd leave that for a nice day. We're back. Yes, you've done the walkway and everything really nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot, Henny, and also Rob, for showing us around.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And talking
have
about
the
castle.
Have the rest of the day.
Yes.
You're going to relax now or doing more things?
Relax, I think.
Relax,
thank you
yeah.
very much.
Okay.
That was really nice. So, how often is Baggett's Castle open?
April till October is the season.
Yeah.
Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
And bank holiday Mondays.
Yes.
And then the winter, I think it just gets too wet and dangerous.
Yeah.
As people would fall down the slope and the car park would get churned up and all that kind of thing.
That's it. So it's open from what time till what time?
It opens 10:30. And then last entry is 3:30.
Yeah.
And get shut at 4:00. But if it's best to get here a bit before 3:30 because
It
takes an hour or so to get there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sure.
We'll come back when it's a nice day, I think.
Bye. Have a nice day.
Well, bye bye. That's all for my report on Baggett's Castle. So it's bye bye from me, Dave Monkson. Bye bye from Elizabeth.
Bye bye.
Sarah, our resident expert on the sporting life, has a sports quiz for you. Good luck.
Hello and welcome to Sarah's fiendishly difficult sporting venues quiz. Now, I've put together 15 questions, but our kind editorial team have split it up to give your brains a little chance to recover. Okay, here goes. Question 1. Which team plays at the Emirates? Easy peasy. Question 2. What is Leicester City's home ground called? Question 3. Where was the 2025 Open Golf played? And yes, I do mean the British Open, although it's actually just called The Open. Question 4. Which football club plays at Hillsborough? Question 5. Which event is held at Flushing Meadows in the United States? Question 6. What is Plymouth Argyle's home ground called? Question 7. Where do Harlequins Rugby Football Club play their home matches? Question 8. Who plays at the Oval? Question 9. Where is the French Open tennis played? Question 10. Which famous team competition was played this year at Farmingdale, New York State? Question 11. Infamous for flooding every winter, you see it on the telly. Where do Worcestershire County Cricket Club play their home matches? Question Question 13. What is Burnley Football Club's home ground called? Question 14. The ground of which Premier League football club is named or sponsored by a credit card? And finally, what is the hallowed turf formerly called the Ricoh Arena now called?
That almost brings us to the end of this week's programme, so it's goodbye from the Outlook team and from me, Peter Walters.